to teach us what we're a part of, what you are doing in the world and what you want to do through us in the world. Lord, we ask that you would raise our eyes above the mundane, the daily. Those are the things that attract us, and well, the things that we have to do. But sometimes we lose track of why. So, Lord, I just ask that you open our eyes to see the why and wherefore of what you are doing in the world. Amen. Today we continue our saga of God's meta-narrative. The Wrath of the Dragon is the one that I have selected for today. Let's see, Matt Brock here. There you are. Okay, you got Adam with you today, or is he in Sunday school? Noah. Sunday school. Okay, well, he's going to tell me he really missed out, because we're going to deal with dragons today. A few weeks ago, he was sitting here when we did the zombie thing, and he thought, wow, this is cool. I'm really missing out when I go to Sunday school. So he came by the next week, and there were no zombies, and he was really disappointed. So, but today we're going to deal with dragons. In this series, I've introduced the idea of meta-narrative, the concept that there is only one story in the whole world, and that all the stories that we hear, that we see, are all molded from this, all draw from this, that God has molded history and he has wired our minds to the conception of God's grand narrative, so that when we see it, when we're exposed to it, we recognize it. It touches us in a deep way. And of course, it's the scripture that is our number one source, our pure source of meta-narrative. It's the thing that really explains to us what it is all about in true terms. But we're exposed to it every time we read a fictional book, we watch a movie, and all sorts of sources. For instance, fictional books, movies that are fictional stories, even history and biographies when they're taught right. When they don't become just sort of boring dust and details, then they can rise to the way of encouraging us so that we see Winston Churchill as a great hero or whoever it might be. In other words, instead of just focusing on details, the idea is connecting history with the grand narrative, because God is the one who designs history. Also in music, the concept of a leitmotif, and in fairy tales. I'll get to that in a minute. But a leitmotif is very common in music from the Romantic Age. Listen to this piece that is on YouTube. It's from The Man of La Mancha. And what I want you to do as we hear Linda Eder sing this is think, what does this stir up within you? And then I'll talk more a little bit about what a leitmotif is and how that relates to meta-narrative. Okay, Adam, you ready?
The sound of the drum.
All right. All right, we need, there's a sound back. All right, I could have picked any one of dozens of pieces that are secular, and that's what this is. This is from originally a book from the 1500s, Don Quixote de la Mancha, and was made into, in the 20th century, made into a musical. And what you see is, if you're familiar with it, is that it's touching on all kinds of things. For instance, Don Quixote's kind of a crazy man. So he's the most unlikely of heroes. And yet, the whole thing is dealing with how do you live for that which is impossible. The impossible dream comes from that. All right. And so what I'm looking at here is basically, what does this stir up within you? Adam, could we get our video back? It's... Yeah, it is, but why am I not having a...
technology ain't it grand.
Okay, I'm back to stick figures next week. I'm remarkable. All right. What kind of things were stirred up within you by the music?
For me, the music makes me want to go out on an adventure.
Yeah. It stirs up adventure, a sense of quest, which is one of the themes in the movie. And It draws you to higher and nobler aims, even if it means something that you can't do but is worth doing, even if the end result is death. And I mention this term leitmotif because what we find in fairly modern music is where themes are set to a particular character or situation. This was famous with Wagner even in his operas in the 1800s. But what we find even in the movies today, it's almost always connected that way. So that if you hear the tune dun 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 dun, then you know that Darth Vader's just around the corner. And if it's da 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 da, then here comes Luke Skywalker and his companions to save the day. Or if even sharks can have their own leitmotif. Boom, boom, boom. All right, so that's what a leitmotif is. Well, what is it? It's actually touching the meta-narrative that is controlling our hearts so that we respond to the right things, things that are high and noble. It's engraved within us, whether we're reading it in words, seeing it on paintings, or hearing it in music, or reading it in the scripture. It's enabling our eyes to go beyond details to see that it's a part of something bigger, something more. Now, one of the best expressions of this is fairy tales. That's probably one of the best expressions of meta-narrative, and it's simple enough that it stirs a little child. But adults can be caught up in it as well. They usually start out once upon a time. It's something that transcends some time of history. And even if it's talking about kings and queens, we see it as something beyond a historical story. It is somehow once upon a time. It is timeless. And that's the whole intention of it. Well, today we are going to be looking, I'm going to tell you a fairy tale. And of course, all fairy tales are true if they touch on the meta-narrative. But this is one that is prophetic. So if you will look with me at Revelation chapter 12. And I'll start here by telling you a story. While you're looking it up, it's Revelation 12, verse 1 following. All right. Once upon a time,
there appeared in heaven a woman clothed in the sun with a crown of 12 stars about her head and the moon under her feet. And she was in pain of childbirth. And also in the heavens appeared a hydra, a many-headed dragon, an evil dragon, an evil red dragon, an evil red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems. After sweeping a third of the stars of heaven with his tail, he pounced and waited before the woman so that when the child was born, he might devour the child. She brought forth a son, a male child, destined to rule the nations with a rod of iron. And before the dragon could carry out his evil plan, the child was snatched up to God and to his throne. The woman then fled into the wilderness, pursued by an overwhelming flood. But God prepared a place of safety for the woman and brought her there on eagle's wings to a place of safety. When the and she was safe for 3.5 years. And there was war in heaven itself. And the dragon, the deceiver, the accuser was cast down to earth. And heaven was liberated from the accuser. Woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, knowing that he has only a short time. And when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman. And the dragon raged day and night against the seed of the woman in a war like nothing before in the history of the world. But the seed of the woman overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb and because of the word of their testimony. And they did not love their life even to death. So here we have the story. Sounds an awful lot like a fairy tale, doesn't it? And the reason that I come to it is what we have here is at the beginning of history, we saw in Genesis 3:15, the war of the seed of the woman, the seed of the serpent. And now at Revelation, at the end of history, it comes right back to that theme that has been the theme of history all along, the conflict between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. And so we see this in very pictorial and visionary form in this particular thing. So notice then, Genesis 3:15, and I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head and you shall bruise him on the heel. Revelation 12:17, so the dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her seed. My translation says children, but it's not the usual word for children. It's the word which means seed. They're making John is making a direct connection between what's going on here and what was promised at the beginning of history in Genesis 3. So, who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. So, what we see then here is the fulfillment of everything that is going on. And usually we can't see this picture going on in heaven. But what I wanted to encourage us to do is to embrace using our imagination as a part of what it means to know God and to worship God and to know what He is doing and what it's all about. Because if we don't allow our imagination to grip the big picture, then what we will do is live our life in the mundane. And what it will lead to is nothing but seeking pleasure of our own. You know, if you don't know why you're fighting a war, kind of like in the last days of Vietnam, then you have all kinds of problems with drugs, all kinds of problems with depression, all kinds of problems because they didn't know why they were there anymore. And if we don't know why we're there, here, then what else do we do except live for comfort and pleasure? And so we have to grasp this. I'm convinced more and more as I study this that we're approaching the sharing of the gospel in a wrong way. Because so often what we do is reduce it down to 4 logical points. Not bad points, true points. But we don't give context to it. So then a person will receive Jesus because he doesn't want to end up in hell. He's been saved from something, but he doesn't know what he's been saved to. because he hasn't seen the big picture that he's entering into a struggle, a war, and he's just changed sides. And so it becomes important for us to grasp the bigger picture. Now, this particular story, and I basically related it to you in my own words, but it basically came out of chapter 12 of Revelation. But there are four major meta-themes or four major themes that come up that are part of, they show up all the time in literature, but they show up at various places in the Bible. One is the concept of the mother of redemption. Notice that the dominant figure here at the beginning is a woman. And the place of the female is very important. And I think we need to reiterate that today because nowadays the place of the woman is to be a man. All right, so now it's not unusual for men to have men's adventure stories. Men are out conquering, but now it's Laura Croft, Tomb Raider. Or it's Jennifer Garner doing whatever Jennifer Garner does. And so these pretty little girls run into these big strapping guys and beat them up. In other words, their glory is being a man. And trying to be feminine about it. You know, straightening their hair after they beat the guy up. Okay. Yeah. All right. And what we see, though, is that these are departures from the grand meta-narrative. The meta-narrative has an important role from Genesis 3 onward. The woman is fundamental. But she is fundamental as a woman, not as a pretend man. And I think that's important. The mother of redemption. We'll talk about that next week in detail. We are entering into the Advent season. Last Sunday was the first Sunday of Advent. So I think it's particularly appropriate to take up some of these topics as we lead up to the time of remembrance of Christ's incarnation. So the mother of redemption. And of course, Mary fits into that pattern, but she's not the only one by any means. The child who would rule. Isaiah 9, the expectation of a child who would rule, the wrath of the dragon and the seed who would overcome. Those are four major themes that come right out of this story, but they show up everywhere in the best of literature and the best of movies. All right, so I think it's important. And over the next 4 weeks, I'm going to be dealing with each of those subjects. Today, I'm going to focus on the wrath of the dragon. All right. Notice in our passage, look, if you will, at chapter 12 there, and you'll notice in the first verse, it says, a sign appeared in heaven, and it talks about the woman. And then another sign appeared in heaven, a red dragon with seven heads. These signs literally appear in heaven. I was reading this. And I thought, you know, that sounds an awful lot like the description of constellations. And as I looked it up, I found I was not by any means the only person who had thought of that. Some clever people and some wackos have all thought of that. And I won't say which category I'm in, but I'm one of them. So, but what we find is that you don't have to know a whole lot about astronomy to know a few of the constellations. And one of the constellations is Virgo, the Virgin. Right next to that is a massive dragon called Hydra, a multi-headed dragon. Both of them are constellations that have been there, they've been there all along, but even in the star charts from ancient times, they had these designations. Virgo was always recognized as a virgin for some reason, not just a woman in the sky with diamonds. No, she was always recognized as a virgin. And so I think that's important for us to recognize. So here's the first sign that appears. And this is done in sort of a star chart fashion with the stars designated. Now, one of the things that you should probably be aware of is when you look at these different things in the sky and try to find them, you say, how in the world did they get that out of those stars, right? Well, let me clue you in. They didn't. It's the other way around. The story came first. The star chart became a way of teaching those stories. And you find them among the ancient Egyptians, the ancient Babylonians. You have Hebrew names for them. These go back a long way, maybe back almost to the beginning of creation, in which somebody thought up these things. Somebody obviously with prophetic ability, or with God saying, okay, I want you to outline these stars. And so this becomes important. So this virgin, by the way, the Greeks called this woman Parthenos, which is the Greek for virgin. And it's exactly the word that is used to describe Mary in Matthew chapter 1. Now, all this took place to fulfill what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet. Behold, the virgin shall be with child and shall bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel. Now, one of the things that I should mention, just to advance your knowledge of constellations and astronomy, for whatever that's worth, is in the ancient charts, there were always 48 constellations. There were the 12 major ones, and each one of those had three small constellations connected with it as sort of an interpretive guide of what was meant by the main one. And so one of the, and these were called decans, these three that were accompanied each one. The one of the first decan for Virgo is called Coma. Now, coma in Greek and Latin is the word for hair. And so when the Greeks came upon this and they saw coma, they kind of scratched their heads and they said, well, what's this about hair? And they came up with a story about a queen who gave her hair to the gods. And so it became known as Bernice's hair. But the word coma actually comes from Semitic languages from the Middle East, and it means the desired one. And so what you have in the ancient ones is not a head of hair. You've got a woman sitting on a throne, and she has a child, small child. In other words, it's a virgin with child. Going back well beyond the New Testament, well beyond even Isaiah 7, to the most ancient of times, you have these things, the desired one, the desire of nations. Well, next to that, you have Hydra, the multi-headed dragon, another sign that appears in heaven. There are a number of serpents in the sky, but this particular one is interesting because it's the biggest of the constellations, and its tail stretches out and encompasses a third of the stars of heaven. And so it's hard to miss the picture here. Now, the reason I mention this is not to get all absorbed with this, although this time of year you often hear about things related to the Star of Bethlehem and that sort of thing, and it does make you wonder. And there are three or four different explanations of how that would work, but my point is that God's meta-narrative, his grand story, his divine story, that we are a part of us, touches us, that we're part of, touches us everywhere. In the stories we read, in the even the fairy tales, in the music that we listen to and like, and also even in the heavens above. God's story is there. And if we open our eyes to see it everywhere. I remember a number of years ago, a homeschooling mom was reading through Lord of the Rings with her children, and she said, oh, it's such a Christian book or set. And I read them, and I said, this is not Christian, it's pagan. But what it is, because it doesn't have anything about the supreme God, it doesn't have anything about salvation in the personal sense. And so I realized that what she was doing was picking out the meta-narrative, the things that touch the things deep within us, that cause us to respond to it. And it raises us up. It lifts us up to a higher nobility. So let's look at this passage now in more detail. And I want to focus on the dragon. In the future, I'll come back to the same passage to deal with the woman and the child and the overcomers. All right. First thing you need to know about this passage is that it's a chiasm. Not a chasm, a chiasm. All right, that's a literary figure of speech, and it helps us to understand the passage. In a chiasm, you have a string of thoughts at the beginning of the passage, and then you have that same string of thoughts changed and modified at the latter part of the passage, and in the middle you have this statement that is emphasized by the way it all comes together. So let me show you how it works in this passage. First of all, starting at the top, point four, because we're starting in the middle and working backwards each way, the dragon is against the seed. This is one of the things, the themes that comes out here, is that you have this one who is the dragon. And he is poised, ready to destroy the woman. And let me look up the specific verses here. In verse 3, "And behold, a great red dragon having seven heads and ten horns, and on his heads were seven diadems." Notice that this description is parallel to the description of the kingdom of the beast or of the Antichrist on earth that you have a few chapters later in chapter 17. And so here we have a heavenly version of the earthly situation, that Satan is the head of this kingdom. That is, the dragon is against, standing against the seed in order to accomplish his purpose. The second thing that we can see is that the child is drawn up to heaven, but heaven helps the woman. All right, so we have a vision in heaven of a woman. We have a vision in heaven of a dragon. We have heaven helping this woman to escape from the dragon. The woman flees to the wilderness, to a place that was prepared for her. And the dragon is cast out of heaven after there was a war in heaven. Five times in this first half of the segment there, the first chapter, part of half the chapter, it uses the word heaven. So what's going on there is about heavenly things, heavenly battles. And then the latter part, what we see is a parallel. So at verse 9, the dragon is cast out. Verse 13, it says, "And when the dragon saw that he was cast out." There's making a parallel here. Very common in the Bible to use this structure. Again, the woman flees in the wilderness. It's a repetition, pretty much, of what we've already seen in verse 6. All right, and so notice that there's an intentional parallel to the structure. And just as heaven helps the woman to flee, now earth helps the woman because it opens up and swallows a flood of water that the dragon sends to destroy her. And so earth helps the woman. And then the dragon, when he can't get at the woman, he goes after the seed of the woman, who is no longer Jesus. He's gone up to heaven. But the seed that comes after that. All right, so this is the basic structure. And the emphasis then is always placed on what's in the middle. So it's sort of like you're reading it from both sides if you see it and recognize it. And what it talks about is you have a section of praise there in which salvation has now come to heaven because the dragon has been cast out. So there is a deliverance in heaven. But woe, it says, to the earth, for the dragon is now on earth. All right, and it's a description of the final days of the battle. All right, and when it talks about in verse 11, those who overcome, it's basically talking about the war in heaven. Those who overcame were those who had these characteristics. All right, but now you come down to verse 17, and you have a similar statement there where it's talking about attempting to destroy the seed. Let me give you several characteristics of some points about the dragon. All right, so here's a problem with dragons. In case you didn't know, the Bible has no friendly dragons. Puff the magic dragon did not make it. All right, so dragons are bad. You see a dragon, run, okay? All right, so here are 8 points about dragons. First of all,
This dragon is a heavenly power associated with earthly kingdoms. His power is not a spiritual power, as in that which comes from God, but it's a power which overwhelms the nations and controls the nations. The vision in heaven of the seven-headed dragon is the same you see of Mystery Babylon. And so there is a connection here. It's about power. It's about political power. It's about earthly power. Also, he fomented a rebellion in heaven, looking back to the time when that occurred. Verse 4, and his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. So what we have here in this vision in chapter 12 is basically a panorama of history. All right, you want to see it in the big picture, the big scale? This is it, all right, or much of it. And so the vision is a panorama. Interpreters agree that the stars of heaven are angels, and that's why you'll often hear people comment, you know, that a third of the stars of heaven, a third of the angelic powers went with Satan. All right. And the third point, he attempted to devour the sun, who might be called also the seed, with a capital S, who is destined to rule, but the dragon can't destroy him. In other words, he's out to destroy the seed, but the seed crushes his head. All right, and so we see that theme coming through. And we also might mention that in verse 17, I've mentioned this already, but where it says, he went after the woman's children, my translation says, it's the word seed. He went after her seed. In other words, there is a conflict that not only involves the devil and Jesus, but it also involves all those who belong to Jesus, because we are of the seed. The promise was to Abraham that he would have seed that would multiply as much as the stars in the sky. Very appropriate analogy. And he also says, hey, Abraham, I'm going to make you a blessing to the nations. So not only will he have Jewish descendants of huge numbers, but we are included in Abraham through Jesus Christ, Galatians tells us, so that now we too are of the seed, and therefore, guess who's against us? A dragon with seven heads, and he's a bad guy, not Puff, the other one. All right. So, he attempted to devour the sun, and then in point four, he attempts and will attempt to destroy the woman. Now, a lot of times you'll hear interpreters, especially in the Catholic Church, but this is true outside the Catholic Church too, who will take this vision as a vision of Mary. Well, it seems like an obvious kind of thing just on the surface. She's the one who gave birth to the Son. But notice that it also says that she fled into the wilderness for 3.5 years. Mary never did that. This is talking about Israel as the mother of Messiah, as the woman that is going to be a thorn with the devil from the beginning to the end. And so a place will be prepared for Israel in the last days. Then we come to number 5. He will be cast down out of heaven to earth. You know, as I read this passage and some others, I get the distinct feeling that things are a lot different in heaven than we might imagine. If we think of it as a place of peace and serenity, as a place where everybody goes around playing harps. Never been real interested in harps, but, you know, if that's what you want to do. All right, but what is this thing where you've got a dragon up there now accusing the brethren day and night? What's this thing about a war in heaven?
what we will be entering into at the time we die is not a nice, placid, peaceful situation, but coming before the throne of God in the midst of a whirlwind of activity going on. Because whatever the conflict is on earth, it's also going on in the heavenly places. And the time will come when Satan will be cast out and down to earth, but that hasn't happened yet. And when it does, well, it's going to be tough. All right. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels waged war with the dragon. The dragon and his angels waged war, and they were not strong enough, that is, the dragon, and there was no longer place found for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, serpent of old, who is called the devil and Satan, in case you're wondering who the dragon was, who deceives the whole world. Notice, he deceives and he is an accuser. And he is certainly vindictive. All right, and so he was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. If things are bad now, they're really going to get bad when all the angels are kicked down to earth. One result of that, however, is that heaven will be unbound. Right now, there is a conflict that's going on there. I don't understand how that works. God is sovereign. He's in control. But the angelic powers, the demonic powers, have access. We see in Job that on a regular basis, Satan would come before God to accuse people. And it says in this passage that he does it night and day. All right. And so there's a lot going on there that we don't know about. But it's part of the adventure that is going on that we are part of. The epic we are involved with is not just things going on earth, but it is a cosmic struggle. Pretty much what you see in all of the different epics. It's something that draws the gods in. And if we consider the gods being various demonic powers, that's pretty descriptive of what we have in God's genuine meta-narrative. So, the dragon's wrath will be against the earth, and it goes into considerable detail there about how he will try to destroy the child. He can't. And so he persecutes the woman who gave birth to the child. She's given two wings of great eagle. It's given to her, so she flies into the wilderness where she was nourished for time and times and half a time. That's 3.5 years. The last half of the tribulation, in other words, in which God protects her. All right. And he will be opposed by the seed. If you look at verse 17, I think this draws it to our application. He will be opposed by the seed. He's opposed to the seed. But when we connect verse 11 about the overcomers and verse 17, which seems to be describing the same sort of thing, because it says these are those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. That's similar to what's said in verse 11. All right, and so we need to understand then that we are in the midst of this warfare. And the point that is being made in this chapter is the overcomers will overcome in heaven. So that should be an encouragement to us that we as overcomers need to stand firm. The idea of an overcomer, and I'll cover that in several weeks, but it's very common in the book of Revelation. Every church that he addresses, he says toward the end of it, to him who overcomes will be given this or this or this or this or this. All right, and so we are overcomers. By the way, all believers are overcomers, not just a portion. That's the promise of the new covenant. We have been transformed. And I'll cover that in detail when we come to that week. But the main thing that I want to leave us with today is the understanding that we are a part of something big, that the vision that's being expressed here is a description of the overview of history, that we are involved in a warfare, not just in do we make it to church on time on Sunday, which might be a victory for some of us. But nevertheless,
we have to work on the assumption, we have to be able to get our imagination wrapped around this, that we are part of something bigger. I love it when the little kids, you know, they'll, for a birthday or something, they'll get these armor, the armor of God, you know, the plastic breastplate and the shield and the sword, and they go running around. They have no idea what they're doing, but it's captured their imagination. All right, so if you're having a hard time, then go down to your local Christian bookstore, get yourself a plastic sword and shield, and but better, take up the true armor of God and realize that our warfare is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. And so at every little point, when we need to see someone come to the Lord, when we need to see victory in our own life, when we need to see some sort of thing that will forward the ministry of Household of Faith or of the Montgomery's down in Mexico or any ministry that the Lord places in our midst or in our consciousness, realize that we are entering into a warfare. And we need to be able to see it as that. We need to lift our eyes and see that there is a conflict that goes on, a conflict of the ages. Let's commit our time to the Lord. Lord, we do commit ourselves to you as the one who is all-powerful, the one who has woven history to be what it is, who has brought us into an epic adventure that does involve danger and a great and powerful enemy. But we have a greater and more powerful king. Lord, help us to see what your role for us is in your purpose. Amen. We are dismissed. And I would remind the ones in the shepherding that we'll have lunch in a few minutes upstairs.